dive right in for a big fat Greek holiday.
There is an idea of warmth and friendliness. It's hard to explain, an acceptance, and you feel that.
Coming up, a tour guide from Athens separates the cliches from the customs for the next time you're in Greece. Seeing the treasures at the Louvre is a big part of visiting Paris.
If you walked through every room, it would give you 9 miles of exercise. It would take about 18,000 steps.
Elaine Chalino shares her tips for enjoying the world's largest and busiest museum. But to get away from the tourists, there's a lot to recommend in the Balkans of Southeast Europe.
And they are some of the most beautiful and interesting destinations in Europe, but they've got kind of a branding problem, I would say.
My right-hand Balkans expert tells us what he found and recommends from his latest adventures in the region. Come along for the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Advice for tackling one of Europe's most visited attractions as well as some of its least touristed destinations. That's on the menu for today's Travel with Rick Steves. After years of exploring the massive Louvre Museum, Paris-based journalist Elaine Chalino has ideas to help anyone fall in love with the largest museum in the world. And Cameron Hewitt shares his latest discoveries from recent wanderings on the Balkan Peninsula. But let's start the hour whetting our appetite for the full-bodied culture of Greece. Greece's friendly people, mouth-watering cuisine, and vibrant music traditions meld into a lesson in good living for travelers. Lively, loud, spirited, it's a joy to surrender to the Greek way of life. And to help us better understand the passions that drive Greek culture, I'm joined today by Greek guide Apostolos Douros. Apostolos lives in Athens, and he's been guiding now for almost 20 years. Apostolos, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rick. It's a great pleasure to be here.
You know, Greece is one of the most touristed places anywhere in the world. I would imagine tourism is a big part of the reality of being Greek. How important is tourism to the Greek economy?
Oh, it is huge. And now that tourism is developing more and more, and I would have to say it's one of the number one sectors of economy, and thousands of people are employed in tourism in different, of course, positions. From management, you can imagine the number of tavernas and hotels and rooms to let, taxi drivers and boat staff and airline companies. It is huge. Yep. For a small country of about 11 million people.
Now, with the dominance of tourism and the importance to the economy, I would think the challenge for a lot of travelers is to connect with Greek culture in a way that's not just touristy and cliches on stage and going to kitschy restaurants with Zorba the Greek dances, but to actually connect with today's culture. As a tour guide, what are your tips for helping a traveler better connect with honest Greek culture?
The first thing I would have to say is to hang out with the locals, to go where the locals go. That's a great advice I always follow when I travel as well. Go to a place where you see the local people. They're having the Greek coffee. They're having the rouzo with their meze. This is where you're going to find the people, so you can feel like a local. You see what people eat, what they're doing in their everyday life. So the first one is connect with the locals.
And you just mentioned meze, ouzo, and coffee. Each are very important parts. They're sort of a ritual. Can you very briefly describe the importance of those three things?
Well, first of all, the Greek coffee, the coffee culture. The Greeks, they love drinking the morning coffee, and they go always to a cafe or a coffee shop. So this is where the day begins, and you can start having a conversation with the locals by having a Greek coffee. It brings people together. And of course, food, the meze, the ouzo. Greece is a country that food is a value. It brings people together. So by people sharing their own food, and it's very common in Greece to share our food, have family-style dinners, it brings people together. And I think this is the most important value of people connecting through these habits, let's say.
Even in Athens, I was walking around the Syri neighborhood, and I believe I was with you, and there was a little door in a long, long passageway, and we came to a funky little local diner, and people were eating meze, little shareable food on dishes. And the main thing that I came away with was conviviality. The cat, the dog, the laughing between the waiters and the customers who the waiters knew their names, the menu that was only in Greek, not in English. I felt very welcome there. And it was a cultural experience because I had a good guide, and I was encouraged to get away from the traditional dishes and try something special, try something different. And that's the beauty of the meze, isn't it? You can try a variety of things and have an educational experience as well as an unforgettable meal.
Of course, and you can share. You don't have to go and take just one dish each if you go with your friends. You can take different dishes and you can share. And I would have to say to people, the travelers, don't be scared. Ask the locals.
Don't be scared.
Yeah, don't be scared. Go to the little taverna. Sit down. Even if the menu is in Greek, people are going to explain to you. You can say, oh, I'm going to have what other people are having.
People are friendly.
Yeah.
People see you. They're impressed you're there. They want to help you. They're not going to tell you to go back to the international fast food chain. They're going to help you have a good Greek experience.
They're going to smile at you. You can try to speak just a little Greek, say kalimera. People are very inclusive. So I think they're going to have a wonderful experience and always they're going to think that moment of connecting with the locals.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're joined by Greek guide Apostolos Douros right now. He's calling in from his home in Athens. And Apostolos organizes small group tours in the northwest of Greece, as well as to the island of Crete. His website is wondersofknowledge.com. You can also find out more about Apostolos and listen to our past interviews with him in the show notes for this episode at ricksteves.com/radio. You know, Apostolos, when a lot of us Americans get to Greece, we have these images of Zorba the Greek and throwing plates against the wall and that kind of clichetic Greek culture. Is that still genuine, or what does a Greek person think about that when he sees a bunch of tourists playing Zorba the Greek?
It used to be more a part of the culture, but it was more, let's say, targeted to the tourists. Of course, Zorba the Greek is a beautiful book. It was made to a beautiful film. So I would say, yes, it is a part of the culture, but that's not what really characterizes Greece. And the number one, it's the friendliness of the people and the freedom you feel traveling in Greece.
The freedom. What do you mean by freedom?
You have this sense of freedom that you're free to do whatever you like. Of course, under the laws and your own restrictions, but you have the feeling that it's very freestyle.
Mm-hmm.
That you can easily communicate with someone. You can stop someone in the street and ask them something, and people are going to reply, and you can communicate. There is an idea of warmth and friendliness. It's hard to explain, an acceptance, and you feel that.
That warmth. I was in Greece one Easter, and Easter time in Greece is amazing. I visited in a small town, and the godfather and the godmother were visiting their godchild, because their tradition was to dye the Easter eggs together. And it was so beautiful, and all of the Easter eggs were red, and they gave the girl a little candle, if I remember correctly, an Easter candle. And the warmth and the hugging and the joy and the happiness and the tradition, I felt like I was in a dreamland. It was the most magical and endearing moment that I had in that whole trip. And it was just seeing grandparents loving their granddaughter, dying Easter eggs, just like we do on the other side of the world.
Yes, Rick. I mean, you were very lucky you had this experience because customs, traditions bring people together, and you can still see that in Greece. So, of course, we're a society that progresses, but also people keep the traditions and the values. And that's a great time, Greek Orthodox Easter, to be in Greece. Go to a liturgy, go to a procession. It is amazing to be a part of the local culture and participate, even if you don't understand. Just be there.
I did. I was walking with the entire village through Napoleon, holding a candle. And we were processing. That's what it was. It left the church and everybody falls into line. And we walked all around the town. And then several processions came together on the main square in front of the main church. And they set off their fireworks. And then they went home to big feasts. To be able to be there, to witness that, and to find the welcome. I was so welcome to be a part of the scene. It was wonderful. Apostolos Douros is on the line from Athens as we look at the appetite for life that seems to permeate Greek culture right now on Travel with Rick Steves. He organizes small group cultural tours in Greece at wondersofknowledge.com. You know, Apostolos, when I'm in Greece, there's three things that I'm sort of fascinated by. And I'm just going to say these three things, and I'd love to get your response to them. A goat on a spit, the click of worry beads, and incense in the church. Do those mean anything to you? Because they seem very special to me.
They are. Of course, the goat or the lamb, we cook at Easter time on the spit. Very important. It's a part of the food culture at Easter. But not only at Easter, when you want to celebrate, you can cook that way. And of course, the worry beads, it reminds me of the local coffee shops where the gentlemen of a village, they go and hang out and they play cards and they have their ouzo and they play their worry beads. And then you said about the incense in the church when you enter a church. And I would like to share that with our listeners. Go to a church. It doesn't mean you have to be a Christian or a Greek Orthodox. No matter what religion you are, enter a Greek Orthodox church just to feel like how it is. So yes, the incense, the smells, the aromas of the churches, they are a part of my childhood memory, but still today.
Oh, incense creates a whole atmosphere. They change the incense depending on what kind of atmosphere they want to create. When I get surrounded by incense in an Orthodox church, it takes me someplace. And that's one thing that I think, those are examples of the richness of Greek culture. I'll never forget when I was in a small town and everybody had a goat or a lamb on a spit, they pulled the iron stick out of the lamb and it just crumpled onto one big plate. And we all ate it together, like communing together. And then the click of those worry beads with the coffee ritual, it just reminds us that time is not money to be spent. It's to be celebrated. It's to be enjoyed. Apostolos, we've got a couple minutes left, and I'd like for you to share favorite childhood memories so we can have a little better understanding of Greek culture and Greek traditions. What are some favorite childhood memories you have?
I have a childhood memory from the northwest of Greece when I used to go and visit my grandparents in the country house, and we used to go to all the local festivals. The elderly people would cook the local food with fresh ingredients, and the kids would go and help in the kitchen, and people would sing and dance. We didn't have the technology we have today, so people would focus enjoying the moment of all generations, of all ages. So this is something I keep as a memory, this warmth of the people of getting together.
To close things off, what is a piece of advice that you would give anybody dreaming of coming to your country so they get the most rewarding and meaningful experience?
I would say to be open to new experience, approach the people wherever they go, and try and visit lesser known places. They're going to be rewarded for that. Don't be scared. Just find out new places to go, away from the crowds, smaller villages, something that will add to you a total new experience on your travels.
Apostolos, thank you so much for joining us to give us a little better angle on enjoying our next visit to Greece. Best wishes.
Thank you, Rick. It's always a pleasure.
Head just north of Greece for uncrowded discoveries in the countries of the Balkan Peninsula. We'll tell you where in just a bit. But first, Elaine Chelino shares how she fell in love with the massive Louvre Museum in Paris. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Have you ever visited the Louvre Museum in Paris? Maybe you came away a bit overwhelmed and exhausted by it all, like I did on my first trip. The massive collection of 500,000 paintings, statues, and other works of art spreads out over the largest museum in the world, and to see it, it requires a game plan for how you're going to prioritize what to see in its more than 400 rooms. Like me, Elaine Chelino doesn't remember much from her first visit. But living in Paris since 2002, she's had countless hours to lean into its magnitude and to learn about how it operates by talking with curators, guards, and fellow museum goers. Elaine brings her journalist's perspective for making sense of it all in her latest book. It's called Adventures in the Louvre: How to Fall in Love with the World's Greatest Museum. Elaine, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Rick, as always.
You know, of all the museums in the world, the Louvre really is unique, isn't it? How is it special?
How is it special? It's special because it's so big and it's so filled with so many extraordinary works of art. It started not as a museum, but as a fortress, and then it became a palace, and only then did it become a museum, which is why it's so mixed up, or ungapachka, as you might say. And that makes it really, really hard to deconstruct and to follow and to master.
You know, if you were able to fly over it and you look down at the footprint of the Louvre, you do see a square section at one end, and then it grows in lengths over the reigns of different kings and so on through the ages until it's a giant horseshoe. Let's pretend we're two birds flying over the Louvre. Give us a little tour of what we would see looking down.
Well, I think it kind of looks like a Tetris. And in the middle of this Tetris is the pyramid. And already you're confused because it already makes no sense. You don't know where to go in. You know, how am I going to not only get into this place, but master this place, especially if I come with a spouse and my two kids or three kids? And it's just so, so big. I mean, it's...
But let's go way before tourism, Elaine, and yes. You'll find the court, what is it called, the cour carré, the old courtyard?
The cour carré. The square courtyard.
I've been underground from there, and you can see the giant walls, the circular turrets that fortified a fort.
In 12th century.
So that's 800 years ago. And you can see these ramparts that are now underground because Paris has risen over the centuries. But that was the core. And before there was even a notion of a museum, before most of this art was even done, it was an important building. And then it grew and grew and grew to be, I think, at one time, the biggest building in the world.
That's right.
How did that happen? Take us in a chronology just of the architecture.
Well, it was king after king. You know, it started with Philippe Augustus, who was a warrior, and he wanted to build a fortress, and he builds this fortress and goes off to the Crusades. It takes him 20 years to build the basis of the Louvre. And then over the centuries, various kings and queens put their marker on it. It's kind of like interior decoration or renovation, you know, not by committee, but by all these individuals with big egos.
By royal ego. I was going to say royal ego. You walk through and you see the banners of the different kings. And I just love that. If you can see the letters entwined, you go, oh, that's Louis the so-and-so or Napoleon or whatever. And it goes century after century after century until now. You walk for blocks and you're still walking along the same building, aren't you?
Well, if you walked through every room, it would give you 9 miles of exercise. It would take about 18,000 steps. So if you're really, really an exercise maniac, just walk through every room of the Louvre.
You know, I've got a photograph, Elaine, of me laying on the floor of the Louvre as the exhausted tourist. I call it the victim of the Louvre. And it was quite difficult to get that photograph because every time I laid down looking like I had passed out, people would gather around me and think, oh, can I help you? No, just relax. I'm just getting a stupid photograph to teach people how big the Grand Gallery, the longest gallery. I think it's a quarter mile long, this one gallery.
But let me remind you, Rick, that you were one of the first people I interviewed when I started this project because I wanted to know how you master the Louvre with normal people. My book is a book for normal people. And, you know, how do you make everyone feel like an insider without doing all the homework? And so you told me early on, you said, Elaine, my mother told me I had to go to the Louvre. So I dutifully went to the Louvre. But it's not easy. It's not supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be hard work. And you really have to invest. It's like going to battle.
Okay, well, that's the thing, because there's a lot of buildings that people end up hating. And one of them is the Louvre, if they don't know how to approach it. The subtitle of your book is How to Fall in Love with the World's Greatest Museum. So what is your trick? How do we not leave it exhausted and frustrated, but leave it wanting to go back and having had a lovely experience? What's the trick for somebody who enjoys the Louvre?
Well, I have one basic rule. Never go to the Louvre on an empty stomach or with a full bladder. Because you think you're going to go, oh, I'll just go into the Louvre and I'll grab a little sandwich or I'll go to the toilet in the Louvre. You won't. You'll already be frustrated the minute you go in. So what you have to do is you have to prepare yourself. You go to this little cafe next to the Louvre and you sit down and you pretend you're French and you have a coffee and a croissant and you go to the toilet in the basement and you get yourself all caffeinated and ready for action. And if you do that, you'll be a lot happier.
You know, when we think of the lay of the land, it is a little overwhelming. And the point you make is, typical tourist just stampedes in and wants to see all the most famous pieces of art. There's 8 or 10 pieces that everybody wants to see.
Sure.
But it is a museum you can go back for the rest of your life. You wrote, its grand galleries, obscure wings, tricky labyrinths, illogical corridors, and narrow staircases can overwhelm even the most passionate art lovers. But you also fell in love with it. Where is some place in the Louvre that is really special to you other than jockeying for a spot in front of the Mona Lisa to get your selfie, you know?
Well, in my past life, I spent a lot of time in Iran, traveling through Iran. You know, I covered the Iranian Revolution. And what I discovered once at Persepolis was the gift shop. And in the gift shop were postcards from the Louvre, because the Louvre has some of the most extraordinary colored friezes of what should have been at Persepolis.
Wow.
And I can go into that room and imagine what it was like being in Iran. And no one goes into those rooms. And it's fun going into a room of the Louvre and feeling as if you own it, because you are alone with a work of art and away from the crowds and crowds that are obsessed by the Mona Lisa and all of the famous big oversized French paintings, and just relax.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're immersing ourselves in the Louvre right now with author Elaine Sciolino. Elaine is a contributing writer and a former Paris bureau chief for the New York Times. She's written several books about Paris, and her latest is called Adventures in the Louvre, How to Fall in Love with the World's Greatest Museum. You can find more about Elaine's work at her website. It's elainesciolino.com, and that's spelled S-C-I-O-L-I-N-O. And you'll find previous interviews we've done together in our radio archives. Elaine, when we think of the Louvre, I think of it as a triumph of the people, the commoners. In fact, you even quoted me in your book. I just stumbled onto that. I was preparing for our interview, and I wrote something. It's the triumph of the people. The commoners have gone wild. It's a celebration of life. What does that mean to you?
Well, you know, you said it, and you told it to me, and it helped me in my research. It's the people's museum. The Louvre was created because of the French Revolution, you know, in 1793, and it was open to all.
Yeah, to give some people that context, it is kind of a historical thing. You cut off the head of the king and the queen, and you just inherit the biggest palace in the world and the greatest art collection in the world. And it's a people's revolution after all. What are you going to do? Hang the royal collection in the palace, open up the palace for the people, and voila, you've got the Louvre. Isn't that kind of what the Louvre's all about?
100%. And also put in all of the art that you stole from all the churches and from the nobility who either fled or who were decapitated were in the French Revolution.
So when people complain about all of the unwashed masses, you know, stampeding through, I kind of look at it as a triumph of democracy, because it used to be this elite place where just the nobles and the royalty were, and the masses of the people would never be able to enjoy that. Today, it's the opposite. It is the domain of the masses. And I like going into the Apollo Gallery. Isn't that where all the regalia is, the crowns and the scepters and the orbs?
Yes, and I think you even told me that the Apollo Gallery was one of your favorite places in the Louvre, because at the entrance of the Apollo Gallery, it is announced this is a people's palace. But the Apollo Gallery was sort of the precursor to Versailles. I tell people, if they don't have enough time to go to Versailles, just go to the Apollo Gallery and you've got a mini Versailles, you know, started by Louis XIV, and it contains the crown jewels. But I have to tell you something. One of the things I discovered in doing my reporting on the Apollo Gallery is there are very few crown jewels in the Apollo Gallery. So I asked the question, where the heck are the crown jewels? And I discovered that in the Third Republic, there was such an anti-monarchical feeling that they had a grand auction at the Louvre and auctioned off most of the crown jewels, and Charles Tiffany bought a third of them. So
wow.
That there are very few French crown jewels, unlike Britain or even Iran.
When you think of the big picture of the sweep of art through Paris, it is interesting that the collection of the Louvre kind of stops in the middle of the 1800s, and then the story is picked up a little bit down the river at the Orsay Gallery, right?
Yes.
But in the Louvre, if you were to say what it is, it's art from before Christ times, from ancient Greek times and before, Mesopotamian times or whatever, all the way up till 1848 or so.
Yes.
Why does it cut off at 1848?
Well, there was just too much art. Uh-huh. And so they had to spread it around. So the Louvre, unlike the Metropolitan Museum in New York, for example, is not an encyclopedic museum. You can't get a sense of the grand sweep of all of art by going just to the Louvre. As you said, it ends in 1848. And so then you've got to go to the Orsay Museum across the river. And then if you want to go see modern art, you have to go to the Pompidou. This is a real investment of time and energy for a normal kind of American visitor, certainly, but any kind of a visitor.
But that's a very good tip, is if you want to follow, trace the sweep of art history in Paris, you do have those three museums. The Louvre gets you up until the middle of the 1800s. The Orsay takes you the next 100 years or so. And then the modern contemporary art would be at the Pompidou. Elaine Chelino is helping us find new ways to enjoy the massive Louvre Museum in Paris right now on Travel with Rick Steves. She writes about its allure, romance, and even its secrets in her book, Adventures in the Louvre. Elaine's previous books include The Seine, The River That Made Paris, La Seduction, How the French Play the Game of Life, and The Only Street in Paris, about her neighborhood around the Rue des Martyrs. The French government has awarded Elaine a Chevalier of the Legion of Honor for contributing to the friendship between France and the United States. A fun part of your book, Elaine, was when you talked about the different types of visitors. Well, let me just let you review three or four of the different kinds of visitors to the Louvre.
Well, how do you make the Louvre yours? And one of the things I say in the book is choose your Louvre identity. Give yourself an identity. Are you a marathoner? Do you have to see everything? I mean, I interviewed people who have gone to see every single room and every single vitrine, every single glass case in the entire museum. It takes over a year to do that. Or you can be the sprinter. You can say, okay, I have 20 minutes and I'm going to see the big three, the Mona Lisa, the Venus de Milo, and the Winged Victory of Samothrace or Nike. And you can then rush out and you can say, okay, I've done it. I've seen the best of the best. And that's true. Or you can be like Umberto Eco, the Italian writer, a minimalist, and go into the Louvre and just go and see one work and sit in front of one work for an hour.
Yeah, I remember you wrote Umberto Eco, who you just got to love. You quoted him, I think he said, a half hour of intense contemplation enjoying a single statue or painting satisfies the spirit.
Well, exactly. And the way to do that, if you really want to know and understand the Louvre as a visitor, what I tell people, my dirty little secret is you and your partner of whatever, spouse, boyfriend, girlfriend, invest 120 euros and become a member of the French Friends of the Louvre, the Société des Amis du Louvre. And for 120 euros, you can get a pass, a year-long pass, that will give you any access in and out with no waiting in line, with no reservation, any time. And it is a golden pass and it's a golden idea. And to wave that little card and to just cut the line and go in as if you are the director of the Louvre or a visiting royalty is something else. So that you don't feel like you don't feel like you have to see everything. You can literally go in for a half an hour, leave, come back.
Well, you're not really like the director of the Louvre because that would be what you call the eternal explorer. And that was Henri Lorette, who lived in the Louvre. I didn't know that was possible.
He lived in the Louvre. But that's how much he wanted to get to know. But you know what? Even Henri Lorette said to me, I said to him, so Henri, after all these years, do you know the Louvre? And he said, you have to come to the Louvre with great humility, that it would be pretentious to say that you know the entire Louvre.
Amen. Hey, you've written a book, and the subtitle, as we mentioned, How to Fall in Love with the World's Greatest Museum. I'd love to know, just to cap this little love fest on the Louvre, where's your favorite personal spot? Where do you find the most joy?
Oh, that's a tough one. This is going to sound weird.
Maybe not the spot, but a place that a lot of us tourists might appreciate being inspired by.
I have a favorite place of contemplation, but it may not be for everyone. Mm-hmm. It's sitting in the ground floor underneath the Islam collection on a banquette, on a bench in the back. And it's dark, and all you see is the light on various works of art. And what I love is the quiet and being in this extraordinary place where you can just be surrounded by beauty, but feel quiet and contemplation and meditation.
You know, I would say, Elaine, that the typical tourist experiences only crowds and shuffling in the museum, and that's their fault. And three-quarters of that museum is quiet, tranquility, and being surrounded by art almost all alone. And if you can venture to some of those distant corners of the Louvre, it's still great art. It's always, Lou Gehrig in the shadow of Babe Ruth, when you got the Mona Lisa getting all the attention. Mm. So find yourself in those beautiful, quiet corners and surround yourself with art made by painters whose names you don't even know.
100%. Exactly. Wonderful. Give yourself the freedom to get lost.
Elaine Chelino, thanks for joining. It's always good to talk with you about your love of Paris and appreciation of great culture and high art. And you've written a book about the pinnacle of high art, Adventures in the Louvre, How to Fall in Love with the World's Greatest Museum. I hope to see you there.
Inshallah, I'm there.
All right. Elaine Chelino's book, Adventures in the Louvre, How to Fall in Love with the World's Greatest Museum, will be released April 1st. Elaine also has in-person appearances scheduled through May in the greater New York and Boston areas, plus Philadelphia, Atlanta, the San Francisco Bay Area, and in her hometown of Buffalo. Details are with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. By the way, they've just announced plans to renovate the museum's entrances by 2031 and to display the Mona Lisa in her own room to better organize the mad rush to see her. Find uncrowded discoveries in the Balkans. That's next on Travel with Rick Steves. As much of Europe is just inundated with tourist crowds lately, the southeast corner, that's a region called the Balkans, offers travelers good off-the-beaten-path options. While the region does have some places that are popular with tourists, most of it just doesn't register with Americans. But the region is starting to be better appreciated for its rustic charms, its lack of crowds, good prices, and as a great destination for travelers who've yet to venture out of Western Europe. My friend and fellow guidebook author Cameron Hewitt joins us now with a report from his recent trip to the untouristed corners of the Balkans in basically former Yugoslavia. Cameron, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Boy, oh boy, you're carving out new frontiers for Americans to travel in, and the Balkans are really something. Now, let's get some context. It was basically former Yugoslavia and a little bit more, right?
Yeah, the western half of the Balkans was Yugoslavia, the eastern half, Bulgaria and Romania. It's basically the southeastern peninsula of Europe between the Adriatic Sea on one side, the Black Sea on the other, going from basically Hungary in the north to Greece in the south.
Now, we say Yugoslavia because you and I are old guys. Some people might not even hardly remember Yugoslavia.
It was quite a while ago, but
Was Yugoslavia?
Well, so right now there are seven countries that used to be one big country, Yugoslavia, which lasted through the early 1990s when, of course, there were all these wars between various factions there. But, you know, even today, a lot of people in many of these countries are still sort of nostalgic for they talk about ex-Yugo. It's sort of the shorthand.
Yeah. Well, we also know the word Balkan as kind of a political term for a place that's just rough and tumble or arguing all the time, or what is that term?
Yeah, it's kind of tragic, especially in the 1990s during these wars. That name sort of became synonymous with interethnic strife.
Because Balkanization is a thing when things fall apart.
Yes, and things in the Balkans are very complicated when you dig into the history, both recent and old. Of course, you might know World War I started in the Balkans with the assassination of the Austrian Archduke in Sarajevo. There are a lot of kind of longstanding grudges. At the same time, there's a lot that unites the people of the Balkans. And I think these days, I feel like people are starting to reclaim Balkans not as a term of derision, but a term of pride. And I think there's a lot of Balkan pride going on.
Well, there's quite a bit of bad baggage. If you happen to be a tourist destination wanting more people to come, hey, come on over here. It's the land of Balkanization.
It's a tough sell. Lonely Planet had a book, I think they still do, that they call the Western Balkans, which is the area we're talking about. Boy, that's a tough term to market, right? And they are some of the most beautiful and interesting destinations in Europe, but they've got kind of a branding problem, I would say.
So, Cameron, in my introduction, I mentioned that there are a few well-touristed corners of the Balkans. So to start out, what part of the Balkans are already popular with tourists?
Well, first and foremost, Croatia. Croatia is hugely popular, and it constitutes the majority of the Balkan coastline in a lot of ways. So if you've been somewhere in the Balkans, yeah, it's probably Croatia.
The Dalmatian coast, Dubrovnik and so on.
All that stuff, yeah. And then Slovenia up in the north is also becoming a little more known. Both of those countries are in the European Union. You know, they have the euro and open borders and so forth. So they're very accessible, and I would say those are the hot destinations in the Balkans.
And you wrote in your blog about certain places are touristed, but not with Americans.
Yeah, when you get to kind of away from those very touristy places and into the heart of the Balkans, places like Bosnia and Serbia, Macedonia and Montenegro and so forth, I was often the only American that I was aware of. But that doesn't mean they're not touristed. You have a lot of people from other parts of the Balkans or from Eastern Central Europe. And then in Sarajevo in particular, and in Bosnia, there's a strong Muslim heritage. And you get tourists from the Muslim world.
Because,
yeah,
you know, they say this is the most Western minaret on a mosque or something like that. I mean, this was sort of an outpost of Muslim civilization centuries past in former Yugoslavia.
Yeah, the Ottoman Empire occupied most of what we now think of as the Balkans. And so they left behind a lot of that heritage. And in Bosnia in particular, it's become a very attractive destination for people from the Muslim world, mm-hmm, who want to kind of get a look at Europe, but they want to go to a part of Europe that is culturally more familiar to them.
Cameron Hewitt is my senior content manager at Rick Steves Europe. He co-authors the Rick Steves Guide for Central Europe and for Croatia and Slovenia, Budapest, Greece, and even Iceland. He features his favorite travel blogs and photos at CameronHewitt.com. Right now, we're hearing about Cameron's latest discoveries from recent travels in the countries of the Balkan Peninsula. I'm so fascinated by your recent adventure. I mean, you took a break from researching the many Rick Steves guidebooks where you're such a valued contributor, and you went on vacation to places that we don't even mention in Europe. Say some of the names of places you'd went to, just so we can hear the names, because these are household words in those places, but they're new to me.
Yeah, I wanted to do a road trip and just connect some dots I'd never been to or hadn't been to in a while. Places like Sarajevo, Belgrade, Podgorica, the capital of Montenegro, Kosovo, of course, the capital there, Pristina. Prizren is another beautiful town in Kosovo. North Macedonia, Skopje, the capital there. Lake Ohrid, also in Macedonia. And then while I was there, I went into Albania also. So I went to the capital, Tirana, went to Gjirokastër and Berat, which are a couple of beautiful kind of hill towns. Really had a wonderful time in all these places.
I don't know how you could probably spell them too with the right...
with all the right diacritics.
Hey, another thing that adds the confusion to me is, you might have known it if you're an old timer having traveled there in Yugoslavian days by a different name, Titograd.
Yes, so Titograd was originally Titograd. Now it's Podgorica, is the capital of Montenegro. It was turned into a big capital during the early post-war years and took the name of the Yugoslav leader Tito, and now it's back to Podgorica.
So once upon a time there was Leningrad, Stalingrad, Titograd, and yep, now they're all different.
And now they've all often reverted to a traditional name or something, yeah.
I would just like, before we delve into some of these places, let's talk about just general what we call nitty-gritty for travelers in the region. You know, red tape, visas, money changing, language barrier. What's the basics?
So I would say traveling in these places is really not that much more complicated than other parts of Europe. There's no visas required for Americans to go to any of these places. English is widely spoken. I didn't have any trouble. I don't speak these languages. I had no trouble getting around. I would say the most complicated thing is connecting the dots if you're doing a multi-country tour, because each country is very much its own sort of entity, and it's hard to get a bus across a border or a train across a border. And so the biggest challenge I had was just making the itinerary, figuring out how to connect a few key dots to be efficient. And I did a variety of trains, which can work well, and buses, and then I rented a car for part of it as well.
This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we are uncovering lesser-known destinations in the Balkans right now with guidebook author Cameron Hewitt. Cameron spends about a third of the year researching and updating guidebooks, and he's written a book called The Temporary European: Lessons and Confessions from a Professional Traveler. Cameron's website is CameronHewitt.com, H-E-W-I-T-T. So, Cameron, let's talk about a few of the places you went to. Not anything famous, not Dubrovnik, not Sarajevo even, but places that you didn't see any other Americans. What's your takeaway?
Well, in particular, for example, I was really taken with Kosovo, which I didn't expect to like as much as I did. It was, frankly, a box-ticking exercise. Like, well, I should go to Kosovo while I'm there. And I just was so charmed by it, and I think it kind of embodied what I loved about the whole region. Really interesting, complicated history and heritage. This is a place that's shared between Serbs and Albanians, who are mostly Muslims. And yet, I had a lot of wonderful individual interactions, both going to important historical sites and talking to people. And I came away with a much greater understanding of this place that we might remember from news headlines. And now I understand it on a more intimate kind of personal level.
That's a small country kind of, I see it as kind of slapped onto Albania on the north and the west side. That is a lot of Albanian culture and heritage, but it wasn't in the Albania that we remember being the most isolated country in the world. So you could get a taste of Albania by going to Kosovo.
Yes, and why it's complicated is it was historically the homeland of the Serbs, a totally different group. And it's mostly Albanian now, but there are still important Serb cultural artifacts there. And so therefore, the Serbs don't recognize Kosovo even as a different country. But yes, that's why it's fascinating. I love these places that are complicated because you really come away with a deeper understanding of all of these. If you go with an open mind and kind of ask questions, you come away with a broader understanding of a place that became just sort of headline fodder. You know, Kosovo is literally where the Yugoslav War started in the 1990s. It's also where they ended in the early 2000s. So it's a hugely important location. And even as someone who loves this region, I had never been there. And it was just fascinating and wonderful to be able to get to know it.
You know, if I think back in the communist times, every big city had its obvious little vacation destination nearby. And in Poland, it was Zakopane, I think, up in the mountains. Budapest, it was the big lake.
Balaton.
Everybody went to Lake Balaton. And in Serbia, for Belgrade, it feels like people go to Lake Ohrid.
Yeah. Well, Serbia, really for the whole region, but Lake Ohrid it's on the border between North Macedonia and Albania, but it's close to Kosovo and it's close to a lot of these places. And that was another really beautiful place. One thing I haven't mentioned maybe enough is this region has incredible natural beauty. It's very mountainous. It's very rugged. Lots of lakes and mountains and beautiful rivers and so forth. And Lake Ohrid, which is sort of tucked in the mountains in the middle of this region, is a very beautiful, historic, and a popular resort. But again, it's very popular with people from the Balkans, people maybe from Eastern and Central Europe. And as an American, I felt like it's busy, but where are all the Americans, you know?
Okay, so we're kind of dancing around the borders of Albania. And I know you're very enthusiastic about Albania. It's kind of almost another topic for an interview. But what was your take on Albania?
Yeah, Albania it's really hot right now. It kind of has been picked up, especially in European media, because it's a great budget beach destination. It has beautiful beaches, and it's very affordable. And I just wanted to take a look at it. I was at the capital and some of the hill towns. I also went to the beaches. My takeaway is I really liked Albania. There was a lot to like. I found the people very charming, sort of disarmingly welcoming, and it was fun to learn about. The beaches are kind of an interesting case. They are some very beautiful beaches. But, you know, it's a fledgling destination. And one thing that happened that I thought was really interesting, everyone in Albania was telling me this, they had a big year last year and they got a lot of press. And so they raised all the prices because they'd gotten all this attention. And then suddenly no one wanted to come to Albania because this was a place where people from Britain or Germany were going for a budget beach vacation. And now suddenly it was the same price as, you know, Greece or Croatia. And it's like, well, no, we were going partly because it was cheap and it's not cheap anymore. So it's been interesting to see they're figuring out you have to kind of be competitively priced and figure out what your niche is. I think Albania's niche is sort of an affordable beach or mountain town break. And if they try to raise the prices too fast, it's not going to behoove them probably.
What about safety? You know, because when you travel around Europe, you hear a lot of people cursing Romanians and Albanians for stealing their cars and this kind of thing. You're right there in that territory.
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of, especially in other parts of Europe, stereotypes about this. I got to say, I felt very safe. And I'm, you know, of course, I'm a guy who looks like he could probably handle himself. So maybe others would have a different experience. But I felt very, very safe. And I've heard it said by other travelers of various backgrounds. They feel as safe in the Balkans as they do in anywhere in Europe. In fact, safer than they do in a lot of big Western European cities. You know, as with anywhere, you have to be mindful of pickpockets. I was a little nervous about having a rental car going into Albania, and because that's sort of the stereotype. Albanians steal rental cars. So there was a joke once to Europeans in Germany, for example, come to Albania, your car is already here, was sort of the old stereotype. So I asked around about this, and a lot of local people and people in neighboring countries said, yeah, that was a stereotype. There might be a little bit of that, but you're not going to be in any danger of necessarily having your car stolen. And I was fine. I felt very safe in terms of personal safety and theft and so forth.
I would imagine you invested in local guides as you traveled. We're both big fans of the value of spending a little money and hiring a local to be your sidekick as you're in one of these places that there's probably not a lot of great travel information in print available. What was your experience with guides?
Yeah, that was my priority. I wanted to spend time with a person from each place. And I had mostly an outstanding experience. Now, I pretty carefully vetted the guides. I asked for recommendations from people I knew and I got excellent value for it. I would say in a place like this, it's very affordable to hire a guide. It's less expensive, and the value they add to your trip is greater than in places where it could be more expensive.
I love that. What's the cost for a guide for half a day, just roughly?
Oh, I spent, it could have been 50 or 100 euros for a half day.
So 100 bucks for a guide for half a day. I mean, I cannot think of a better value, period, in that part of Europe.
And I like the guiding and learning about the history and the facts and figures. But more than that, I like talking to a person from that culture.
Yeah, you've got
learning,
your friend.
Yeah, what's it like to be living in North Macedonia? What's it like to be from Kosovo?
I always joke, when you look at my TV shows, I've always got my friend and fellow tour guide with me. And I said, it seems like I've got friends everywhere in Europe. And then I say, I'm just paying them to be my friends. For 100 bucks, you've got a friend. And they want to do a good job. I think that's really important. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Cameron Hewitt. And I've worked with Cameron for a long time, and he has always been enthusiastic about what we call Central Europe now. Not Eastern Europe anymore, but Central Europe. And Cameron's written a book called The Temporary European, Lessons and Confessions from a Professional Traveler. And he's fresh back from a trip to the corners of Central Europe, the Balkans, and that's what we're talking about now. Hey, Cameron, when you went to the Balkans, I wonder if there's leftovers from the last generation's war. I mean, when I stand on the ramparts of Dubrovnik and I look over the city, you see the dark red and the bright red tiles on the roofs. And your local friend will say, well, the bright red tiles are the buildings that were bombed out and rebuilt in the last generation. Did you have any sense that there was a terrible war here just in Grandpa's memory?
I would say you don't see a lot of actual signs of damage from the wars. It's the infrastructure and everything's been cleaned up. Of course, people have very long memories and very strong feelings about this, and it's different in different places. That can be a really interesting component to traveling here, is hearing firsthand from people who lived through this. My sense was, for the most part, these societies are trying to move on and kind of get beyond some of that old baggage. But there are certainly people in each place who really cling to it. And in certain countries, there's definitely been a flare-up of trying to reignite passions about something from the 90s for political gain. And there's some concern in a few places that that could destabilize things.
So there's simmering, angry sort of nationalism.
Nationalism, yeah. That, and I think that will always be there. A couple of friends in this region have said, I think it could take, if maybe we had one or two generations without any war, it would help put this behind us. But it takes a very long time to recover from some of these things. Often it flares up like at soccer matches, which is kind of interesting. A lot of this stuff comes to a head when people are rooting on their soccer team, especially between two groups who have sort of bad blood between them.
Does it kind of boil down to religious heritages, Muslim, Orthodox, Catholic?
This region has a tremendous, well, part of what I love about it is this region has a tremendous amount of diversity. So, yeah, you have large groups of Roman Catholics and also Eastern Orthodox and also Muslims. You know, it's sort of like Northern Ireland, where it's a little bit less about the faith. These are not like religious battles. It's about the political influence that each group has. The groups are defined by their faith, but it's not a religious war in a sense in the 1990s. It was more about who should politically control this area or that area.
I got to say it's almost that way now in the United States.
Well, I will say I have friends in the Balkans who have the last couple of years reached out a couple of times and said, this is making me a little uncomfortable, because they remember when Yugoslavia broke up in the 1990s. And there are ways that people are positioning themselves that are starting to feel kind of...
We're getting Balkanized.
And I think that's the thing. And I there's absolutely a heritage of that in this region, but it's not unique to this region. And
But on a bigger political perspective, does the region tend to want to look west or east? Because I would imagine a lot of people would be enamored with Russia.
In most of the region, and this is very broad strokes because each country is different, generally they're looking to the west. You know, Slovenia and Croatia are in the EU. When I was in Macedonia, North Macedonia, and also in Montenegro, they were very proud to tell me they had just joined NATO in the last few years. Mm-hmm. That felt like a very important step for them in terms of being integrated with the Western, quote-unquote, Western world. The one place that is really looking to the east more is Serbia. They have historically strong ties to Russia. And so even to this day, of all of these countries, Serbia is definitely the most Russia-friendly.
Cameron, we've got a couple of minutes left. Let's talk about a few of the places on your most recent trip where you mentioned there may have been some tourists, but you didn't meet a single American. How were Americans received when you did walk down a street? Did they know you're an American? Did you get any sense of you were the spectacle?
You know, it was interesting. I thought maybe I would get a little bit of that. But actually, everyone in these places just sort of took it in stride. I kind of feel like these people have sort of seen it all. Their history has been complicated. They've had a lot of people passing through. Although I did feel very welcome. I would say this region really specializes in hospitality. They really do a good job of welcoming visitors.
Is that something to do with this Muslim idea that a visitor from far away is a gift from God?
I think for sure. That's what I've always interpreted it. And, you know, even though in many cases the Ottoman heritage is not something they actively embrace, I think there are these threads from that occupation that have persisted in a lot of these cultures.
It's a nice sentiment. Cameron, thank you so much for being our bushwhacker, heading off into territory that most Americans don't even consider for their itinerary. There's a lot to learn, a lot to, and I would think we're going to see more and more people going to this corner of Europe. And thank goodness Balkanization now is not a way you would describe the region called the Balkans in Europe.
It's a beautiful place, and as other parts of Europe become very crowded and very expensive, we haven't mentioned these are also very affordable destinations. I think the Balkans are really in a prime position to sort of become more and more discovered.
All right, Cameron, we'll check back later and see how it's going. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. And we'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Hey, Rick Steves here. In 1978, I was a 23-year-old piano teacher dreaming of trekking the fabled hippie trail from Istanbul to Kathmandu. With my buddy Gene, we booked the tickets, packed our rucksacks, and set out on the adventure of a lifetime. My new book, On the Hippie Trail, features my journal and vivid photos from that coming-of-age trip. Squeeze into rickshaws, sail the sacred Ganges, and look into the eyes of the Virgin Goddess as you stow away with me on the legendary hippie trail. My book, On the Hippie Trail, is available wherever books are sold.